This is Audible.
Books on Tape presents French Women Don't Get Fat, The Secret of Eating for Pleasure by Mireille Giuliano, read by Kate Mazur. What is more important than the meal? Doesn't the least observant woman about town look upon the implementation and ritual progress of a meal as a liturgical prescription? Isn't all of civilization apparent in these careful preparations which consecrate the spirit's triumph over a raging appetite? Valérie. Ouverture. Whatever the state of Franco-American relations, admittedly a bit frayed from time to time, we should not lose sight of the singular achievements of French civilization. Until now, I humbly submit, one glorious triumph has remained largely unacknowledged, yet it's a basic and familiar anthropological truth. French women don't get fat. I am no physician, physiologist, psychologist, nutritionist, or any manner of ist who helps or studies people professionally. I was, however, born and raised in France, and with two good eyes, I've been observing the French for a lifetime. Plus, I eat a lot. One can find exceptions, as with any rule, but overwhelmingly, French women do as I do. They eat as they like and don't get fat. Pourquoi? Over the past decade, we Americans have made valuable progress in understanding the French capacity for getting away with murder vis-à-vis food and drink. The cautious acknowledgement of a French paradox, for example, has sent countless heart patients and wellness enthusiasts sprinting to the wine store for bottles of red. But otherwise, the wisdom of the French way of eating and living, and in particular the uncanny power of French women to stay svelte, remains little understood, much less exploited. With myself as living proof, I have successfully counseled dozens of American women over the years, including some who have come to work for me at Clicquot Incorporated in New York City. I've also addressed thousands on aspects of this subject in talks. I've been teased by American friends and business associates. When will you write the book? Well, le jour est arrivé. Could it be nature alone? Could the slow wheel of evolution have had time enough to create a discrete gene pool of slender women? J'en doute. No. French women have a system. They're trucs. A collection of well-honed tricks. Though I was born into it, living happily as a child and even a teenager by what my maman taught me, at a moment in my adolescence, the wheels came off. In America, as an exchange student, I suffered a catastrophe that I was totally unprepared for, a 20-pound catastrophe. It sent me into a wilderness from which I had to find my way back. Fortunately, I had help. A family physician whom I still call Dr. Miracle. He led me to rediscover my hereditary French gastronomic wisdom and to recover my former shape. Yes, this is an American story, too, a parable of fall and redemption. I have now lived and worked in America most of my life. I like to believe that I embody the best parts of being American and being French. I moved here a few years after university, and worked as a UN translator, then for the French government, promoting French food and wine. I married a wonderful American, and eventually found my way to corporate life. In 1984, I took the leap that has let me live in two cultures ever since. The venerable Champagne House of Veuve Clicquot, founded in 1772, boldly opened a U.S. subsidiary to handle the importation and marketing of Champagne Veuve Clicquot and other fine wines. As the first employee, I immediately became the highest-ranking woman on staff since Madame Clicquot, who died in 1866. Today, I am a CEO and director of Champagne Veuve Clicquot, part of the luxury goods group LVMH. All the while, I've continued to practice what most French women do without a second thought. And the dangers I have faced for years now are well above average. No exaggeration. My business requires me to eat in restaurants about 300 times a year. Tough job, I know, but someone has to do it. I've been at it for 20 years, never without a glass of wine or champagne at my side. Business is business. These are full meals. No single course of frisé salad and sparkling water for me. Yet I repeat, I am not overweight or unhealthy. This book aims to explain how I do it, and more important, how you can too, by learning and practicing the way French women traditionally think and act in relation to food and life. You too can do what might seem impossible. What's the secret? First, a word about what it's not. So many of us do double duty, working harder inside and outside the home than most men will ever know. On top of it, we must find a way to stay healthy as we try to maintain an appearance that pleases us. But let's face it, more than half of us cannot maintain a stable, healthy weight, even with all the self-inflicted deprivation we can muster. 65% of Americans are overweight, and the fastest-selling books are diet books, most of them now written like biochemistry manuals. No matter how many appear, there are always 10 more on the way. Could dietary technology really be progressing as fast as the marketing? Anyway, the demand persists. Why? Why don't the million copy wonders put a definitive end to our woes? Simply put, unsustainable extremism. Most diet books are based on radical programs. Apart from a brief Jacobin interlude in the 18th century, extremism has never been the French way. America, however, gravitates toward different philosophies, quick fixes, and extreme measures. In diet, as in other matters, these work for a time, but they're no way to live. You're bound to slip out of your zone, fall off your pyramid, lose count of your calories. And why not? C'est normal. It doesn't help matters that one extreme prescription is often contradicted by the very next one to gain traction. Who doesn't remember the high-carb days or the grapefruit days? Now everything's fat and protein, and carbs are the devil. First dairy products are your worst enemy, then they're the only thing you can eat. Ditto wine, bran, red meat. The unstated principle seems to be, if you bore yourself to death with one kind of food group, eventually you'll lose interest in eating altogether, and the pounds will come off. In some cases, they do. But what happens after you stop the radical program? You know what happens. For this reason, attention, banish the diet book. You don't need an ideology or a technology. You need what French women have, a balanced and time-tested relation to food and life. Finally, the coup de grâce against these extreme programs is their general lack of attention to the individuality of our metabolisms. Written mostly by men, they rarely acknowledge that the physiology of women is profoundly different. And a woman's metabolism changes over time. A woman of 25 with some weight to lose faces a different challenge from that of a 50-year-old. While my stories and lessons can be of benefit to anyone, this book is intended primarily for women, being based solely on my experience as a woman. It's not only for Americans, but for women throughout the developed world who face career pressures, personal stress, globalization, and all the traps of 21st century society. And it is not for those whose weight is an immediate health risk or who require a medically prescribed diet. I speak specifically to women who need to lose up to 30 pounds, which is a great proportion of the population. Nevertheless, like the Tintin cartoons, the story is for all ages, 7 to 77, and I offer advice for tailoring it to the various periods of our lives. Since French women do not live by bread alone, much less high protein, I present a comprehensive approach to living, strategies and philosophy you can make your own, including menus and quick recipes anyone can follow, and, bien sûr, a guide to how we move. Oh, and I like to think that men of all nations could benefit from learning a thing or two about the other gender. Okay, so what are the secrets of French women? How do we account for all those middle-aged women with the figures of 25-year-olds strolling the boulevards of Paris? The following chapters draw on observations from my time in Paris, about 12 weeks a year, compared with my weeks in New York City and around the United States and the world. I invite the reader to reflect on the differences and modify her approach to healthy living accordingly. At the outset, let's state that French women simply do not suffer the terror of kilos that afflicts so many of their American sisters. All the chatter about diets I hear at cocktail parties in America would make any French woman cringe. In France, we don't talk about diets, certainly not with strangers. We may eventually share a trick or two we've learned with a very close friend, some cunning refinement of an old French principle. But mainly, we spend our social time talking about what we enjoy: feelings, family, hobbies, philosophy, politics, culture, and yes, food, especially food, but never diets. French women take pleasure in staying thin by eating well, while Americans typically see it as a conflict and obsess over it. French women don't skip meals or substitute slimming shakes for them. They have two or three courses at lunch, and then another three, sometimes four, at dinner. And with wine, bien sûr. How do they do it? Well, that's a story. That's the story. One hint: they eat with their heads, and they do not leave the table feeling stuffed or guilty. Learning that less can be more, and discovering how one can eat everything in moderation are keys. So are exertion in proportion to calories consumed, and a much more plentiful intake of water. We no longer work 18 hours a day in a mine or on a farm, and our Paleolithic hunter-gatherer days are long past. Nevertheless, most Americans eat at least 10% to 30% more than needed, not to survive, but to satisfy psychological hunger. The trick is to manage and gratify your appetites, while determining how, when, and what to reduce. The wonderful feelings of satisfaction you'll notice when a new menu is introduced, a heightened enjoyment, even as overall intake is decreased, will then inspire you to continue along the wellness road. It's all a matter of learning the most basic of French rules: fool yourself. Many nutritionists, valuable educators, promote a common-sense approach, but charge a fortune to tell you how to implement it. The money spent on attempting to lose weight is out of all proportion with outcomes. Most women simply can't afford to see a doctor or a nutritionist, join a health club, go to a spa, or have meals delivered. What will it cost you to practice the secrets of French women? Well, above the cost of this book, very little. My do-it-yourself approach is within virtually every woman's means. The only equipment is a small scale to weigh some of your foods during the critically important first 3 months. You might also want to buy a yogurt machine if you want to eat le vrai yogurt, a key element in my lifestyle program. And if you are past age 40, you should acquire some dumbbells for strength building. C'est tout. I begin with my childhood in France, and then share my experience as a young woman with a weight challenge. Faced with the first physical wake-up call of my life, I turned to traditional French principles for help. By sharing my experience not only with food, but with a total approach to healthy living, I aim to guide each reader toward finding her own equilibrium. Le mot juste, indeed. It's an important concept, because while our bodies are machines, no two are built exactly alike, and they reset themselves repeatedly over time. A program that doesn't evolve with you will not see you through the long run. I provide menus you can follow exactly, but the goal is to develop what works for you as you cultivate a new intuition. I'm not presenting prescriptions so much as templates. Tailor them according to your preferences, paying attention to your own body, schedule, environment, and other unique characteristics. In fact, my emphasis is on the simplicity, flexibility, and rewards of doing it yourself. This fine-tuning can't be done by a doctor author who's never met you. As I recount my own story from adolescent meltdown to rescue to a new approach that has worked for decades and counting, I lay out a path for you. I take readers through a complete program. Phase 1. Wake-up call. An old-fashioned 3-week inventory of meals. A clear-eyed look at what you're eating, which itself, even after a couple of days, can begin your turnaround. Phase 2. Recasting. An introduction to the French school of portions and diversity of nourishment. You'll identify and temporarily suspend some key food offenders. This is usually a 3-month process, though for some, a month will do the trick. It won't be a dietary boot camp, merely a chance for your body to recalibrate. There is discipline, but flexibility is vitally important, especially at this key motivational stage. The value of avoiding routine, both in meals and in activities, emphasizing quality over quantity. No pizza 3 days in a row, but also no 3 hours at the gym on Saturday. You'll acclimate with your 5 senses to a new gastronomy, a Greek word, even before it was a French one, meaning rules of the stomach. 3 months is not a short time, but neither is it long for something you'll never need to do again. Naturally, it takes longer to reset your body's dials than to lose 7 pounds of water, the initial part of many extremist diets. But because it is French, there will be pleasures, lots of them. Phase 3. Stabilization. A stage wherein everything you like to eat is reintegrated in proper measure. You have already achieved your reset equilibrium and should be at least halfway toward your weight loss goal. Amazingly, at this point, you can increase your indulgences and continue to slim down or just maintain your equilibrium if you're already there. I give advice for practicing ideas about seasonality and seasoning, powerful tools, and not nearly as much trouble as some imagine. I present more recipes based on the French knack for variations on a theme, or how to make 3 easy dishes out of 1 with delicious results, saving time, money, and calories. Phase 4, the rest of your life. You are at your target weight, a stable equilibrium, and the rest is just refinements. You know enough about your body and preferences to make little adjustments in the event of any unexpected drifts, especially as you enter new phases of life. Your eating and living habits are by now tailored to your tastes and metabolism. So, like a classic Chanel suit, they should last you forever, with minor alterations over the years. Now you will be eating in a totally different light, with an intuition to rival that of any French woman, a cultivated respect for freshness and flavor that unlocks the world of sensory delights to be discovered in presentation, color, and variety. What you do, you will do for pleasure, not punishment. You'll enjoy chocolate and a glass of wine with dinner. Pourquoi pas? In addition to nourishment, which is the main subject, I'll describe aspects of healthy living that need to be pleasurable as well. As with food, these do not require extreme measures, physical, emotional, intellectual, spiritual, or financial, only a sense of balance. They include elements of what I like to call French Zen, which can be learned quickly and easily and practiced anywhere. Mainly, French women do not go to gyms, but if that is your pleasure, à chacun son goût. Even the French know there is much more to life than eating. So here, too, you'll find the French take on other diversions, like love and laughter. From beginning to end, it will be important to recognize that Montaigne's aperçu is more relevant today than ever. A healthy body and healthy mind work together. To maintain both, there is no substitute for joie de vivre, an expression for which there is tellingly no American equivalent. Now I have a few stories to tell, a few dozen, actually. I take pleasure in being a raconteur as well as in eating and drinking. They will drive home basic concepts, but I hope you will also enjoy them comme ça. Unlike a diet book, This book doesn't let you flip to graphics and jump right in. You'll have to read it. Learning to eat right is like learning a language. Nothing works like immersion. Let the tale begin. 1. Vive l'Amérique. The beginning. I am overweight. I love my adopted homeland. But first, as an exchange student in Massachusetts, I learned to love chocolate chip cookies and brownies, and I gained 20 pounds. My love affair with America had begun with my love of the English language. We met at the lycée, junior high and high school, when I turned 11. English was my favorite class after French literature, and I simply adored my English teacher. He had never been abroad, but spoke English without a French accent or even a British one. He had learned it during World War II, when he found himself in a POW camp with a high school teacher from Weston, Massachusetts. I suspect they had long hours to practice. Without knowing whether they'd make it out alive, they decided that if they did, they would start an exchange program for high school seniors. Each year, one student from the United States would come to our town, and one of us would go to Weston. The exchange continues to this day, and the competition is keen. During my last year at the lycée, I had good enough grades to apply, but I wasn't interested. With dreams of becoming an English teacher or professor, I was eager to start undergraduate studies at the local university. And at 18, naturally, I had also convinced myself that I was madly in love with a boy in my town. He was the handsomest, though admittedly not the brightest boy around, the coqueluche, the darling, of all the girls. I couldn't dream of parting from him, so I didn't even think of applying for Weston. But in the schoolyard, between classes, there was hardly another topic of conversation. Among my friends, the odds-on favorite to go was Monique. She wanted it so badly, and besides, she was the best in our class, a fact not lost on the selection committee, which was chaired by my English teacher and included among its distinguished ranks PTA members, other teachers, the mayor, and the local Catholic priest, balanced by the Protestant minister. But on the Monday morning, when the announcement was expected, the only thing announced was that no decision had been made. At home that Thursday morning, those days there was no school on Thursdays but half days on Saturday, my English teacher appeared at the door. He had come to see my mother, which seemed rather strange considering my good grades. As soon as he left, with a big, satisfied smile, but not a word to me except hello, my mother called me. Something was très important. The selection committee had not found a suitable candidate. When I asked about Monique, my mother tried to explain something not easily fathomed at my age. My friend had everything going for her, but her parents were communists, and that would not fly in America. The committee had debated at great length. It was a small town where everybody was fully informed about everybody else. But they could not escape concluding that a daughter of communists could never represent France. My teacher had proposed me as an alternative, and the other members had agreed. But since I had not even applied, he had to come and persuade my parents to let me go. My over-adoring father, who would never have condoned my running away for a year, was not home. Perhaps my teacher was counting on this fact. But in any event, he managed to sell the idea to my mother. The real work then fell to her, because she had to persuade not only my father, but me as well. Not that she was without her own misgivings about seeing me go. But Mamie was always wise and far-sighted, and she usually got her way. I was terribly anxious about what Monique would say, but once word got out, she was first to declare what a fine ambassador I would make. Apparently, communist families were quite open and practical about such matters, and she had already been given to understand that family ideology had made her a dark horse from the start. And so I went. It was a wonderful year, one of the best of my adolescence, and it certainly changed the course of my entire life. To a young French girl, Weston, a wealthy Boston suburb, seemed an American dream. Green, manicured, spread out, with huge, gorgeous homes and well-to-do, well-schooled families. There was tennis, horseback riding, swimming pools, golf, and 2 or 3 cars per family. A far, far cry from any town in eastern France, then or now. The time was so full of new, unimagined things, but finally too rich, and I don't mean demographically. For all the priceless new friends and experiences I was embracing, something else altogether, something sinister, was slowly taking shape. Almost before I could notice, it had turned into 15 pounds, more or less, and quite probably more. It was August, my last month before the return voyage to France. I was in Nantucket with one of my adoptive families when I suffered the first blow. I caught a reflection of myself in a bathing suit. My American mother, who had perhaps been through something like this before with another daughter, instinctively registered my distress. A good seamstress, she bought a bolt of the most lovely linen and made me a summer shift. It seemed to solve the problem, but really only bought me a little time. In my final American weeks, I had become very sad at the thought of leaving all my new pals and relations, but I was also quite apprehensive of what my French friends and family would say at the sight of the new me. I had never mentioned the weight gain in letters, and somehow managed to send photos showing me only from the waist up. The moment of truth was approaching. 2. La fille prodige. Return of the prodigal daughter. My father brought my brother with him to Le Havre to collect me. I was traveling on the SS Rotterdam. The ocean liner was still the transatlantic standard preferred by many French people in the late 1960s. With me was the new American exchange student from Weston, who would be spending the year in our town. Since he had not seen me for a whole year, I expected my father, who always wore his heart on his face, would embarrass me, bounding up the gangway for the first hug and kiss. But when I spied the diminutive French man in his familiar beret, yes, a beret, he looked stunned. As I approached, now a little hesitantly, he just stared at me, and as we came near, after a few seconds that seemed endless, there in front of my brother and my American shipmate, all he could manage to say to his cherished little girl come home was, "Tu ressembles à un sac de patates." You look like a sack of potatoes. Some things don't sound any prettier in French. I knew what he had in mind. Not a market-sized sack, but one of the big 150-pound burlap affairs that are delivered to grocery stores and restaurants. Fortunately, the girl from Weston spoke little French, else she would have had a troubling first impression of French family life. At age 19, I could not have imagined anything more hurtful, and to this day the sting has not been topped. But my father was not being mean. True, tact was never his strength, and the teenage girl's hypersensitivity about weight and looks wasn't yet the proverbial pothole every parent today knows to steer around. The devastating welcome sprang more than anything from his having been caught off guard. Still, it was more than I could take. I was at once sad, furious, vexed, and helpless. At the time, I could not even measure the impact. On our way home to eastern France, we stopped in Paris for a few days, just to show my friend from Weston the City of Light. But my inexorable grumpiness made everyone eager to hit the road again. I ruined Paris for all of us. I was a mess. The coming months were bitter and awkward. I didn't want anyone to see me, but everyone wanted to greet l'Américaine. My mother understood right away not only how and why I had gained the weight, but also how I felt. She treaded lightly, avoiding the unavoidable topic, perhaps particularly because I had soon given her something more dire to worry about. Having seen a bit of the world, I had lost my taste for attending the local university. I now wanted to study languages in a grande école, like an Ivy League school, in Paris, and, on top of that, to take a literary track at the Sorbonne at the same time. It was unusual and really an insane workload. My parents were not at all keen on the idea of Paris. If I got in, hardly a given as the competition is legendary, it was going to be a big emotional and financial sacrifice to have me 3.5 hours from home. So I had to campaign hard. But thanks in part to the obvious persistence of my raw nerves, in the end they let me go back to Paris for the famously grueling entrance exam. I passed, and in late September, I moved to Paris. My parents always wanted the best for me. By All Saints' Day, November 1st, I had gained another 5 pounds, and by Christmas, 5 more still. At 5'3", I was now overweight by any standard, and nothing I owned fit, not even my American mother's summer shift. I had 2 flannel ones, same design but roomier, made to cover up my lumpiness. I told the dressmaker to hurry and hated myself every minute of the day. More and more, my father's faux pas at Le Havre seemed justified. Those were blurry days of crying myself to sleep and zipping past all mirrors. It may not seem so strange an experience for a 19-year-old, but none of my French girlfriends were going through it. Then, something of a Yuletide miracle occurred. Or perhaps I should say, Dr. Miracle, who showed up thanks to my mamie. Over the long holiday break, she asked the family physician, Dr. Meyer, to pay a call. She did this most discreetly, careful not to bruise me further. Dr. Meyer had watched me grow up, and he was the kindest gentleman on earth. He assured me that getting back in shape would be really easy, and just a matter of a few old French tricks. By Easter, he promised, I'd be almost back to my old self, and certainly by the end of the school year in June, I'd be ready to wear my old bathing suit, the one I'd packed for America. As in a fairy tale, it was going to be our secret. No use boring anyone else with the particulars of our plan, he said. And the weight would go away much faster than it came. Sounded great to me. Of course, I wanted to put my faith in Dr. Meyer, and fortunately, there didn't seem to be many options at the time. Dr. Miracle's prescription. For the next 3 weeks, I was to keep a diary of everything I ate. This is a strategy that will sound familiar from some American diet programs, such as Weight Watchers. I was to record not only what and how much, but also when and where. There was no calorie counting, not that I could have done that. The stated purpose was simply for him to gauge the nutritional value of what I was eating. It was the first time I ever heard the word. Since nothing more was asked of me, I was only too happy to comply. This is the first thing you should do, too. Dr. Meyer demanded no great precision in measurement. Just estimate, he said, stipulating a portion as the only unit of quantity and roughly equal to a medium-sized apple. In America, where the greatest enemy of balanced eating is ever bigger portions, I suggest a little more precision. Here's where the small kitchen scale comes in. Bread, which sometimes comes in huge slices here, might be more easily weighed than compared with an apple, which seems bigger here too. 3 weeks later, I was home again for the weekend. Just before noon, Dr. Miracle, distingué, gray-templed, made his second house call. He also stayed for lunch. Afterward, reviewing my diary, he immediately identified a pattern utterly obvious to him, but hiding somehow from me, as I blithely recorded every crumb I put in my mouth. On the walk between school and the room I was renting in the 7th arrondissement, there were no fewer than 16 pastry shops. Without my having much noticed, my meals were more and more revolving around pastry. As I was living in Paris, my family could not know this, so when I came home, my mother naturally prepared my favorites, unaware I was eating extra desserts on the sly, even under her roof. My Parisian pastry gluttony was wonderfully diverse, In the morning, there was croissant, or pain au chocolat, or chouquette, or tarte au sucre. Lunch was preceded by a stop at Poulaine, the famous breadmaker's shop, where I could not resist the pain au raisin, or tarte aux pommes, apple tart, or petit sablé. Next stop was at a café for the ubiquitous jambon beurre, ham on a buttered baguette, and what remained of the Poulaine pastry with coffee. Dinner always included, and sometimes simply was, an éclair, Paris-Brest, religieuse, or millefeuille, curiously called a Napoleon outside France. Always some form of creamy, buttery sweetness. Sometimes I would even stop off for a pommier, a big puff pastry sugar-covered cookie, for my goûter, afternoon snack. As a student, I was living off things I could eat on the go. Hardly any greens were passing my lips, and my daily serving of fruit was coming from fruit tarts. I was eating this strangely lopsided fare without the slightest thought, and with utter contentment, except, of course, for how I looked. Now, this was obviously not a diet I had picked up in America, where one could hardly say the streets are lined with irresistible pâtisseries, though then, as now, there was no shortage of tempting hot chocolate chip cookie stands and cellars of rich ice cream, to say nothing of a mind-boggling variety of supermarket sweets made with things infinitely worse for you than cream and butter. But as I was to learn, it was my adoptive American way of eating that had gone to my head and opened me up to the dangers of this delicious Parisian minefield. For in America, I had gotten into some habits. Eating standing up, not making my own food, living off whatever, n'importe quoi, as the French say, as other kids were doing. Brownies and bagels were particular hazards. We had nothing quite like them at home, so who could tell how rich they were? Back in France, I continued to eat n'importe quoi, though there were no brownies to be found. Perhaps I missed my adoptive second home and was searching for my Madeleine, remembrance of sweets past. In any case, I became very free and easy with all the goodies France had to offer. Finally, I was a millefeuille junkie. Like an addict's, my body came to expect too much of what had once been blissfully intoxicating in small doses. It was time to enter rehab. But fortunately, Dr. Miracle had never heard of cold turkey. The French don't much care for dinde at any temperature. Dr. Miracle's approach was much less confrontational and more civilized. According to him, there are two selves in each of us, the one who wants to be slim and healthy, and the one who wants something else. One sees the big picture, well-being, self-esteem, fitting into the latest fashions. The other wants pleasures aplenty and now. One is Narcissus, leaning over his pool. The other is Pantagruel, leaning over his table. The key, he said, was not to conquer the second, but to broker a rapprochement. Make friends of your two selves, and be the master of both your willpower and your pleasures. That was the French way. One must not forget, he said, il y a poids et poids. There is weight, and then there is weight. There's the ideal body weight that shows up on insurance company charts based on nothing but height. There is fashion weight, an ideal much less natural, in which commerce plays a big, sometimes insidious part. And then there's the well-being weight, the one at which a particular individual feels bien dans sa peau, comfortable in his or her skin, as Montaigne says. This last concept, bien dans sa peau, is the one Dr. Miracle presented as our goal. It is the weight at which you can say, I feel good and I look good. The actual number will vary at different times in our life, but invariably it is based on learning how to be a bit narcissistic while also a bit hedonistic, two notions that are not as bad or even as contradictory as many Americans suppose. Have no fear. I do understand the Calvinist streak. My family are Huguenots, French Protestants.
Tout est question d'équilibre.
Everything is a matter of balance. This was Dr. Miracle's quintessentially French mantra. In those days, it became mine as well, and so it has remained. Teaching me to find and maintain my personal equilibrium, to live bien dans ma peau. That was our mission. There was nothing wrong, he explained, with eating pastries, but my consumption had gone out of balance. So for the next 3 months, I was to pare back, finding less rich alternatives, reserving the real thing for a special treat, as it is intended. This was less deprivation than contemplation and reprogramming, because, as I would discover, achieving a balance has more to do with the mind than with the stomach. It's about discovering and dealing with nos petits démons, as the good doctor called them. Once you realize that changing one's habits, like being a French woman, is mostly a state of mind, you will see why the only truly effective approach is the one that engages your head. Later, I would be bringing back all my favorites, but in balance, enjoying them without guilt or weight gain. Easier said than done? Peut-être. But as we proceed, you be the judge. Dr. Miracle was a good armchair psychologist. He recognized one valuable feature of most diets, even those that fail long-term: quick, positive reinforcement. Overcoming inertia is the hardest part of changing your habits, and everyone needs a bit of early encouragement. Equilibrium must be cultivated gradually. You can't simply impose it on yourself. So I was to do something special that Saturday, to gain a head of steam for the week ahead. But thereafter, I would take it 1 week at a time. Weekends and holidays would normally be times when I would indulge. Gradually, even my indulgences would become savvier. Meanwhile, I would learn to balance them out through a little compensation the following week. Dr. Miracle was something of a gourmand as well. He gave me a number of recipes, but none more important than the one for the first and only tough weekend. On reflection, it wasn't so tough at all, because of his magical leek soup, a trick used by many of the local women for generations. He had prescribed it to both my mother and my grandmother at one point or another. Leeks are a mild diuretic and low in calories, but highly nutritional. 48 hours of leek soup, plus all the water you want, would provide immediate results to jumpstart the recasting. For me, it was the start of a lifelong commitment to wellness, as well as the beginning of my appreciation, my love of leeks, about which there is more to say. It is a trick I still use from time to time. Do try it the first weekend, following your own food inventory. Magical leek soup. Broth. Serves one for the weekend. Ingredients: 2 pounds leeks. 1. Clean the leeks and rinse well to get rid of sand and soil. Cut off the ends of the dark green parts, leaving all the white parts, plus a suggestion of pale green. Reserve the extra greens for soup stock. 2. Put the leeks in a large pot and cover with water. Bring to a boil, reduce the heat, and simmer uncovered for 20 to 30 minutes. Pour off the liquid and reserve. Place the leeks in a bowl. The juice is to be drunk, reheated, or at room temperature to taste, every 2 to 3 hours, 1 cup at a time. For meals, or whenever hungry, have some of the leeks themselves, 1/2 cup at a time. Drizzle with a few drops of extra virgin olive oil and lemon juice. Season sparingly with salt and pepper. Sprinkle with chopped parsley if you wish. This will be your nourishment for both days, until Sunday dinner, when you can have a small piece of meat or fish, 4 to 6 ounces, don't lose that scale yet, with 2 vegetables, steamed with a bit of butter or olive oil, and a piece of fruit. Pity those who don't love the sweet taste and delicate texture of leeks. Eventually, you probably will. If not, follow the example of my cousin in Aix-en-Provence. After the birth of two sons, she needed to shed a few pounds but didn't love leeks. A neighbor suggested hiding the leeks among other flavorful and healthful ingredients. This Provençal version is known as soupe mimosa, mimosa soup. Mimosa soup serves one for the weekend. Ingredients: 1 head lettuce, 1/2 pound carrots, 1/2 pound celeriac, 1/2 pound turnips, 1 pound leeks, 1/2 pound cauliflower, 1/2 cup chopped parsley, 2 hard-boiled eggs, chopped. 1. Clean and chop all vegetables in rough pieces and put them in a pot, except for the cauliflower and parsley. Cover with water, bring to a boil, and simmer uncovered for 40 minutes. Add the cauliflower and cook for another 15 minutes. 2. Pass all the cooked vegetables through a food mill. 3. Serve the soup in a bowl and add parsley and pieces of chopped hard-boiled eggs. Eat 1 cup, at room temperature or reheated, every 3 hours or so, all day Saturday and Sunday, until Sunday dinner, when you can have a small piece, 4 to 6 ounces, of fish or meat, 2 steamed vegetables with a dash of butter or olive oil, and 1 piece of fruit. Somewhat less liquidy and magical than the leek soup, this soup is nevertheless an effective and tasty alternative. Both versions are so good and such an adventure for most palates that you will have a hard time seeing them as prison rations. Especially if these tastes are new to you, jot your impressions of flavor and fragrance on the next clean page of the notebook in which you have recorded your last 3 weeks. In time, this exercise will intensify your pleasures, and you may want to keep a regular diary of your gastronomic experiences, including some wine notes, just as serious enophiles do. 3. Short-term recasting, the first 3 months. While your leeks are boiling, ask yourself a couple of questions. 1. Why am I doing this? Because I'm afraid my husband or girlfriends think I am boo-boom, overweight and dumpy? Because none of my clothes fit? While diets are often inspired by fear and self-loathing, such emotions do not show the way toward living like a French woman. To embrace recasting, you have to be ready to embrace pleasure and individual happiness as your goals. Sounds paradoxical? At least half our bad eating and drinking habits are careless. They grow out of inattention to our true needs and delights. We don't notice what we are consuming. We are not alert to flavors. We are not really enjoying our indulgences, and therefore we think nothing of them and overdo it. Perhaps you have given up caring about fashion or trying other new things. It may be easy for a wife, mother, and full-time worker to neglect pleasure. Perhaps a part of you even thinks it's selfish. But you must understand there is nothing noble in failing to discover and cultivate your pleasures. It will make you not only fat, but grouchy. You owe it to your loved ones as well as yourself to know and pursue your pleasures. And since everyone's taste and metabolism are unique, you must pay attention to yourself, to what delights you, so you can tailor your system and preferences. It's a lifelong commitment, but it promises a lifetime of good health and contentment. 2. Qu'est-ce qui se passe? What's going on here? You can't start eating and living well in a physical or emotional vacuum. Why do you think you have gained weight? Age? Family or work pressure, loneliness, fashion? Believe it or not, some of us tend to gain precisely when styles are at their least forgiving. Just had a baby? Stopped smoking? Always hungry? Grief? Other stress? The possible combinations of mental and physical factors are too vast to list completely. Losing one's equilibrium can be a symptom of a more serious trauma. If it's a devastating problem, you may need some outside help, seek that help. But if it hasn't knocked you totally off stride, chances are you can identify and deal with it on your own. If bad eating habits are your way of compensating for another problem, stay tuned, because French women have a much more varied menu of compensations. If you have traded in your nicotine for potato chips, it's time to consider alternatives. Having said these things, we can proceed to plan the recasting of the next 3 months. First and foremost, this means identifying and reconsidering our worst offenders. Some may be eliminated, others reduced. The right approach depends on your individual needs. Round up the usual suspects. Inspector Renault's famous line in Casablanca, when he lets Humphrey Bogart off the hook for killing the Nazi officer, is an apt command for the first step in recasting. Let's look at your diary. Does anything in your past 3 weeks seem strange? Maybe not. Without Dr. Miracle's objective eye, I might not have immediately identified my own offenders, those foods I was consuming out of all proportion. My big problems were bread, pastry, and chocolate. Not such rare vices. But perhaps for you they are not vices at all. Your consumption of them may be perfectly moderate or trivial. One slice of bread with lunch, a small slice of tart after dinner. Your offenders may be quite different. Analyze your diary by determining what seems excessive in your judgment. You might begin by asking, what could I live without, or at least with less of? Is the thought of those two cosmos at quitting time the only thing getting you through the day? How would one suit you? Or skipping every third day? Do you ask the waiter for more bread before he has even brought your order? You might find one slice savored slowly with dinner just as satisfying, or you might just as easily wait for your appetizer. Do you finish every French fry on your plate? You see where I'm going. This is not radical. Little things do add up. But now, ask yourself something else. Which things do I most enjoy? My glass of wine at dinner? An ice cream cone on Sunday afternoon? Consider all the things you consume regularly. Which of them is giving you real pleasure, and which are you having to pointless excess? One thing French women know is that the pleasure of most foods is in the first few bites. We rarely have seconds. The things we enjoy, we don't enjoy as a matter of routine. Still can't decide what to throw overboard? Okay, time to make like Inspector Renault. Round up the usual suspects. Here are a few things that many women are having too much of. Potato chips, bagels, pasta, pizza, fried foods, juices, beer or hard liquor, candy bars, ice cream, soda, and junky chocolate. If you have any of these daily, for instance, chips on the side whenever you have a sandwich, consider it an opportunity. If, for the next 3 months, you can cut out these offenders altogether without feeling brutalized, go for it. But if one of them is critical to your contentment, reduce incrementally. Juice diluted with sparkling water is more thirst-quenching than juice straight, and you can reduce the juice part slowly. Bread is special, the staff of life for French people, not to be treated lightly. In fact, bread, like chocolate, is one of those rare foods that can be your best friend or your worst enemy. I look closely at both in a later chapter. But if you're having 3 pieces at every meal, bring it down to a piece and just pass the basket if you honestly don't want any. Do not eat on autopilot. Eventually, you will have it only when it counts. There is a life of blissful indulgence out there with less of all these things, even the ones that are basically good for you. Getting there happens once you discover that, on the whole, offenders are foods we tend to eat compulsively, with less actual pleasure than you might think. Often, they are poor versions of something better. For instance, supermarket processed cheeses as compared with a real cheese of real character. When you learn to replace the junk with goodies that truly satisfy, you will learn that the rule of less is more is no cop-out. By then, you'll discover what is obvious to French women. There can be an almost ecstatic enjoyment in a single piece of fine dark chocolate that a dozen Snickers bars can never give you. On that subject, please also eliminate all chocolate loaded with cornstarch, corn syrup, artificial flavors, artificial coloring, and too much sugar. The great 17th century philosopher Descartes is famed for his dictum, "I think, therefore I am." But he also knew a thing or two about how the body and the mind influence each other, and that in order to understand the passions of the soul, its functions must be distinguished from those of the body. A French woman's secret is mainly in her head. It is one thing to identify your offenders, quite another thing to manage them. If we all had an iron will, there would be no need for this book. On average, a French woman is no more likely than anyone else to possess one. But she is much likelier to have mastered the useful art of self-deception, the mental part of living well. In fact, I'd say that complete control of the mind over the body is undesirable. It suggests a lack of openness to the spontaneous delights of the senses. So, how are ordinary mortal women to get through 3 months of offender reduction as we pursue new habits and new balance? Here are the basic principles as learned from Dr. Miracle and adjusted by trial and error over the years. They are presented initially in brief to start you on recasting. But for a lifetime subscription to the secrets of French women, you'll have to absorb them in the chapters ahead. There are more particular lessons one must learn or relearn to reconcile with food. But for now, slow and steady. There is no lasting glory in rapid weight loss. That's what diets offer. A fast, weeks, not months, round of misery for temporary results. If you believe you can shed pounds quickly by force of will and deprivation, you will, in all likelihood, not only regain the ones you have lost, but add a few more besides. This is the origin of the expression yo-yo dieting. If your recasting starts showing dramatic results within a month, you are among the lucky. But a proper recasting, resetting your body's dials, is a 3-month affair. The key is to make it a pleasant 3 months, not a sentence in the Bastille. Variety. As Dr. Miracle counseled, crash diets also run the risk of creating carences, nutritional deficiencies, the dangers of which can be worse than those of excess weight. The answer is not in supplements, but in eating the greatest possible variety of good foods. Such variety will go a long way toward compensating you for those things you miss. You will actually find yourself not missing them so much. It's amazing to French women how much of the same old thing some people will eat. Gastronomic boredom leads to lots of unhealthy eating. If you don't make improvisation and experimentation part of your eating life, you are sure to find yourself in an eating rut. It's as bad as a romantic rut, losing that spark, and just as likely to get you in trouble. French women know the importance of turning a bit of comfort into excitement. Don't know your way around the market? Don't have time to cook? Relax. You don't have to be rich or a 3-star chef to enjoy a vast world of natural flavors. Once you learn a few tricks, it takes surprisingly little effort to cook with variety and no more time than Monday night meatloaf. The next chapter has some examples, and there is a complete arsenal in the seasons and the seasonings. Consider this an opportunity to try foods and flavors you have never tried before. A new cheese you've heard of? A fresh herb? What about skate, or shallots, or mash, or celery root? Or any number of varieties of oyster, one of my personal favorites? Novelty is a powerful distraction. Choose quality over quantity. Pick things in season. Usually the best in season is cheaper than the worst off season. A final trick of variety. Since the pleasure of most foods is in the first few bites, eat one thing on your plate at a time, at least at the start of the meal, when you can concentrate and enjoy the full flavors. The mouthful as mélange, blend of foods, defeats the purpose of variety. Ritual preparation. French women love to shop and prepare food. They love to talk about what they've bought and made. It's a deeply natural love, but one that is erased in many other cultures. Most French women learn it from their mothers, some from their fathers. But if your parents aren't French, you can still learn it yourself. Even though I was a student, Dr. Miracle sent me to one of the best local markets in the Rue Clerc, near where I lived in Paris, 2 to 3 times a week. His advice was simple. Buy only what you need for the next day or two. Forget your twice-a-month mega hauls from the supermarket. I was to cook simply, but cook at home, so as to see and learn what I was putting into my body. In recasting, it is a great help to make and bring your own lunch. Avoid the unknowns of prepared foods, especially the processed kind. Easier than bringing your scale to work. It was equally important to transform my evening meal into a sort of gourmand happening. What's for dinner? Was to become an exciting question with varied answers. Thought and preparation must go into your supper. You must decide that the results you want are worth a little extra thought and effort in the beginning. In no time, you will find yourself doing it automatically. Marketing and cooking were relatively new to me. I somehow hadn't picked up much about them at home, though there were great cooks in my family. But Dr. Miracle insisted that I would have fun with it. Fortunately, most of my university classes didn't start until late morning. Water. Everyone, French and non-French, agrees it is critical, and most of us don't get enough. But it is certainly a boring prospect to gulp down 8 glasses a day as needed. And while many women make a fetish of carrying a water bottle around with them all day, I wonder how many are getting all they need. However much you're having, more can't hurt. If you can't think of reaching 8 glasses a day, for now, add 2 as follows. Have 1 big glass first thing in the morning. Few of us realize how dehydrating our sleep time can be. Perhaps this is one reason why a huge glass of juice, an offender by any standard, seems so good first thing. A morning glass will not only freshen your complexion, it will help perk you up if you haven't slept well. And have a glass when you go to sleep at night. Dehydration is one cause of bad sleep. If you don't have a taste for water, try slicing a lemon into your glass. Ritual eating.